So good morning, Professor Dean. Thanks again for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of time, the goal of these interviews is to go over the genesis of the ideas behind replica symmetry breaking, which in your case concerns mostly the work you did during your thesis days. But before we dive into that, I have a few background questions that I'd like to ask. First of all, can you tell us a bit more about your family and your studies before starting university?
Okay. I was born over here in Australia, and at about the age of 7.5, my father worked in the oil industry. He was a chemical engineer, and he got a secondment over to Great Britain. So we packed our bags and went over there, and it was supposed to last for 3 years, and it never ended. So basically, my education was British. And my interest in science, I suppose, was influenced from my father, who's a chemical engineer, as I said. He worked for British Petroleum and ended up doing a lot of energy economic modeling using linear programming at the time. And 1,000 rows was considered to be a huge model in those days. It was the days of Hollerith cards and that sort of thing. If you could, do you know what a Hollerith card is?
You mean the coding cards, right? The 72 rows.
That's all that sort of stuff. Anyway, yeah. Went to school, obviously, and I was lucky at school that we had some really good science teachers. The chemistry teacher, Derek, he was probably the best of them. Then Jim Bennett, the physics teacher, he was great. And then Miss Pentecost, he was the maths teacher. And I was inclined to do mathematics. My father was, I wouldn't say he was upset about that, but he said, no, you've got to do chemistry, mate. You know, really, you know, that runs in the family. And I preferred physics, although actually I have to admit, at the time I was, I seemed to do better at chemistry. So anyway, I ended up doing physics, which is where I wanted to be. But I was always had a mathematical bent, or interest, I should say, yeah.
So what then led you to pursue a PhD in theoretical physics, and at Manchester in particular?
Ah, well, that's an interesting story. I went to Southampton University, and the physics department was very good there. Although I didn't know how good it was. The reason I selected Southampton University is that they had a dedicated dojo, and I'm really keen on judo, so that's why I went there. And yeah, so I did the degree there. During the degree, I wanted to do a little bit more mathematics, so I got permission to take one or two of the maths courses to go towards a degree, which was, I think there's one on integral equations. I can't remember the other. Anyway, so that sort of says that I was more interested in the theory side and the mathematical side of things. Now, come the great laying on degrees and whatnot, I didn't manage to get a first, which meant I couldn't. I wanted to do research, and my chosen field would have been particle physics, but they had a cutoff in particle physics. If you didn't get a first, you didn't get to study particle physics. Oh, okay, fair enough. So I had a look around, and there was nothing that really interested me. And I thought, well, you know, sod it, I'm going to have to go and work in industry. And one of the tutors there said, oh, there's this guy up in Manchester who's, you know, it's fairly theoretical, and he's counting the conformations of polymer chains. And I thought, my God, that sounds boring. And I thought about it a bit, and I don't know whether I looked up any papers or whatnot, but I thought, right, you know, if it's mathematical, if it's physics, I'll do it. And I went up to Manchester, and it was great. you know, and yeah, I mean, I spent the first year 80. Well, the first year was at Manchester, because Sam then moved to to Cambridge. And on that move to Cambridge, oh, Manchester, by the way, was the judo was even better. So that was a double plus. at that time, and I was given, the problem was the free energy of rubber. That was the problem. And I got to understand what the problem was fairly quickly, but building up the understanding and mathematical ability took quite some time to get going. And at the time, he was working with Geoffrey Allen and Geoffrey G over in the chemistry department, which was just the other side, just the other side of the road. They're looking at swelling. swelling of rubber. They looked at the vapor pressure of, I think it was benzene, but I'm not quite sure, above a rubber to work out what the free energy of the rubber was when it was swollen, and get the contribution of the free energy from the cross length. And it was good actually, because Sam was pretty. He sent me down to UMIST, which is the University of Manchester Institute of Science and Technology, which at the time was a separate institute, but there was a guy down there called Treloar, who was quite famous in the rubber field, and he did some lectures for the technology students there, and Sam sent us down there, and he said, you've got to get a feel for this, and that was pretty good as well, and then when he moved to Manchester, he said, okay, you can join Alan and G and, do the chemistry side of it, or you can come to Cambridge and, do the physics side of it. it was no contest, really. The chemistry that you were doing there was actually quite difficult, because you had to control the number of cross. What they were trying to do was to eliminate the wasted links, where you get a loop in a chain which doesn't contribute to the free energy. So they were doing some really cunning chemistry, which I didn't really get involved in, so that the chains couldn't cross link with each other. I don't know how it worked, but anyway, it struck me as being out of my league. So my chemistry days, I thought, were well over. So I went down to Cambridge, and that was pretty good. The judo was not quite as good at Cambridge, but it was pretty good. So there was 2 years there, and that was the time that Sam became chairman of the Science Research Council. I don't know quite when that happened, but we didn't see, PhD students, we didn't see as much of him as maybe some of us would have liked, but that suited me. There were plenty of people to talk to that were, quite smart, quite brilliant, actually. And then you bumped into the odd Phil Anderson, who was over for his summer vacation, he came over in the summer from Bell Labs. Mm-hmm. It was a very stimulating. In fact, Manchester was the same. People came and gave lectures and whatnot. Very stimulating time. And as a young person who, sort of thought, oh, physics, great. it was a wonderful time.
In your thesis, you describe how to average over topologies of rubber in order to obtain that thermodynamic free energy of the model you're trying to study. Do you remember where this idea came from, and how did you learn about it?
I learned about it from Sam. I think he published the first. Let me just try and get the argument. There was an argument over how many degrees of freedom a crosslink took away. It was NKT, N over 2KT, whatever it was. And Sam did the first calculation with the replica method, mm-hmm. and got N over 2. And he was happy with that. But I can understand why you might want a PhD student to work it through and try and pick it apart and whatnot. The rest of it that came basically in the last year of my thesis was putting in the excluded volume and in particular the entanglements. I don't think that was expected. Well, I didn't expect it anyway, but basically the method I learned from Sam that was well established. Well, in my mind, it was well established. You had to take an average of something which was being taken out of equilibrium without the crosslinks going back to equilibrium. So it's sort of, I looked at it as, oh, you've got to take an average of an average, but it's not, if you see what I mean, it's not the straightforward average of an average. It's an average of something that's changed. And it's a neat method of doing that. In the last couple of years, that was the other thing. Yeah, when you did a PhD there, the supervisors like to send you off to summer schools. I don't know where you do the same thing in North America, but there was one in Leeds, which was very polymer orientated. There was one in Loughborough, which various people from industry came and gave lectures on the different sorts of polymers and what their problems were and whatnot. And then there was the final one, which was my last year at Cambridge, was the Les Ouches Summer School, 1973 one in France. Mm-hmm. And that was just brilliant because it was all theoretical. It was it called, I got the book out the other day, Molecular Fluids, that's what the subject was. And Degen was there as well. So you met up with some, you had lectures from some really, important people in the field. Although at the time I didn't realize it, they were just, just these stars there. You didn't realize what was happening. Yeah.
So Sam brought the replica trick to you early on in your studies. This was sort of the first calculation he got you to work on, or just came up later?
No, that was it, basically. I can't remember what the first supervision was, but it would have been, it would certainly been in the first year, I had to read very, the added advantage was, of course, it was, had to read Feynman and Hibbs's book as well, and that was a connection with quantum mechanics, which is a bit like, particle physics and whatnot. So I thought, oh, well, this wasn't a bad choice after all. it's quite mathematical. the days were spent filling a waste paper basket with calculations that had gone wrong. My measure of success is how full the waste paper basket was. And I like that, actually. And the best part of it, which were the people around. There were some very stimulating conversations and very, you talk about their problems and they talk about your problems and whatnot. And that was the best part of it. Mm-hmm. There were some really bright people around. You do your first degree and you come out, you think, oh, that's it, I know everything now. Right, I'm gonna show the world. And then when you finish your PhD, you go, bloody hell, I know nothing.
So, sorry for the technical question again, but in your thesis, you write an explicit expression for the partition function for integer number of replicas n, right? And you state that the result can be analytically continued to the reals. Was this analytical continuation ever a source of concern, or was this natural way to approach it?
If I could say I never really thought about it, the only thing I thought about the replica system was that maybe you could get some second moments and third moments if you went to n squared, n cubed and all the rest of it. It just seemed a mathematically sound way of getting the result that you wanted. I think that's the only thing about you learned about dimensionality was this business with three dimensions you can get a a steady state, and in two dimensions you don't, and things like that. You know, for, it's the same in electromagnetic theory. You know, when you calculating the field around a wire rather than a sphere, you can, but a wire, it's, there's a logarithmic term there. You've got to put an outside bit, and that this is where two, and it's the same thing with a polymer wandering around. It clumps up in three dimensions, and I don't think it does in two dimensions. And anyway, that's the only thing, dimensionality thing, that I came across that was interesting. I didn't really think about what it meant. You know, what's your question was non-integer dimensionality, is that right?
Non-integer number of replicas, actually. Non-integer. I mean, you were solving for integer n's and then taking n to zero, right? So
yeah,
some simplicit analytic, you're doing an analytic continuation to the reals, for the real n's, to be able to.
Yeah.
But this, you say this was never a concern.
When I say I'm interested in mathematics, I'm more an applied mathematician than a pure mathematician. I think the pure mathematician in me, if there was one, would say, what does this all mean mathematically? But to me, you look at the formula and say, yep, you get the average that you want if you take the limit as n goes to zero. And that, I'm ashamed to say, that was good enough for me.
So what was the reception to your work? How was the thesis received? Or when you were talking about it in these schools?
I gave a preliminary talk at Les Zouches on it. And you see, at the time, Sam had already moved on into dynamics of polymer melts and things like that, which he was far more interested in. I think I was a bit piqued, actually, because I thought, well, if that's more interesting, I should be doing that. But I haven't solved this one yet. So, so I think the interest came after the public, because the thesis was basically Sam had a look at it and said, I'd like to rewrite bits of it and stick it into the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And then after that, I got lots of reprint requests and whatnot. But at the time, I was working. I was doing industrial research for the Electricity Board. So priorities, and I just got married and that sort of thing. So priorities have changed. So I think I went to a couple of meetings discussing these sort of things, but it was only out of interest. It wasn't a sort of, you know, in some ways I regretted leaving university. But in other ways, you see, when it came time to choose what to do, I looked around me and I saw all these really bright people trying to get positions in academia. And I thought, well, I'm going to lose out on the competition. I may as well go straight to industry. You know, that was my thought. And so that's where I ended up doing. But again, it was, and that was the other thing. I didn't really fancy teaching. And somewhere in the back of my brain, I realized that if you became an academic, you obviously had to do some of that. And that wasn't really my forte. I like to do research. And so when I was offered this position at the Electricity Board doing industrial research and whatnot, I thought, well, that's pretty good. Having said that, I still got summer students, because there was a scheme where you kids that were about to go up to university came and worked with you for a month or two. And actually, once I got a really bright student who really pushed my project along. Actually, it was, you know, when you come across a mind like that, you think, wow, gee.
In your thesis, you cite an unpublished work by Professor Edwards on spin glasses that relates to the work you're doing, right, about this replica business. How aware were you of Professor Edwards' own efforts in this direction? And what can you tell us about it? Did you hear about it?
I certainly heard about it. I think I knew that he and Phil Anderson were having conversations, but This was at the time, I think, when he was chairman of the SRC, so he's spending most of his time down in London. And, you know, we had the occasional supervision. It's just one of those things. I didn't mind at all. I think some of the students thought would have preferred more hands-on, but it suited me. So I knew about the spin glasses, but I didn't know much about them.
Had he shared preprints with you, or did you see drafts of the calculation, or this was just what he would tell you?
Oh, no. This was just I didn't look into it in any great detail at all. Okay. I certainly didn't see preprints or anything. Yeah.
So as you mentioned afterwards, you left the field of statistical mechanics. Did you? And you mentioned you kept abreast a bit of the advances in the field of rubbers. Did you pay any attention to spin glasses by curiosity, or this was complete
far
field?
Not really. My mind was filled with predicting dynamic instabilities in nuclear boilers at the time. And yes, engineers really, really want to know that if you make a prediction, it really has to be spot on. Otherwise, it could cost them quite a bit of money. So, I've always kept an oversight of general physics and whatnot. A member of the Institute of Physics, still get the magazine. You can get it online now and whatnot, but I still like to look at those sort of things and see what's happening. I didn't keep up with the field at all.
Is there anything else about this era that we may have missed, or that you think would be interesting to share with us?
Well, to me as a young PhD student, everything was interesting. It was like young kid in a lolly shop, you know. And we must have had lots of conversations about different things. Maybe there was conversations about spin glasses. I can't remember the details, but I can remember there would always be something interesting to chat about. I mean, at Manchester, the sixth floor was occupied by the theoretical physicists, and they had their own seminar room or tea room or whatever it is, and you'd go up there and chat to everybody. The interesting thing about Sam's supervision is that Andy's lectures, actually, he'd start off really low level, you know, and you think, oh yes, I'm following this, yeah, that's fine, and then suddenly he'd take off and you think, look, hold on a minute, I've missed this, you know. And you'd come out after the supervision with a couple of pages full of formula and whatnot, and as students we'd sit around on the table and we'd bring bits and say, well, I recognize what that bit was, and where does this one come from here, and whatnot. And that was actually quite good, but that was his technique. You know, you have to be really careful at the beginning of those lectures. You have to listen really carefully, because all of a sudden, whoop, you know, you're in the stratosphere before you realized it. You know? So I can't think of anything. I suppose as soon as we end this call, I think, yes, I should have mentioned so-and-so, but I can't think of anything in particular that
How often did you meet with him, for instance, while he was in London? Was this once a week, once a month? Once every...
It was certainly less than once a week. He had a very busy schedule when he was chairman of the SRC, because the SRC awarded all the grants for the English universities and things like that. There were occasional meetings in London. I can remember a few get-togethers, you know, not just one-on-one supervisions. I think the supervisions must have dropped to something like once a month or something like that. Okay. I can't remember the details. As I say, as long as you got the general direction and there are lots of people around there to talk to about things. Admittedly, a lot of the people were doing solid state physics, rather than, so he when he came along to the Cavendish that was the first of the, if you like, soft matter physics that started up. And it was called theory of condensed matter, the group. And I think they, when he came along, they got this extra bit to it, which was the, you know, polymers and liquid crystals and all those sort of things. And even going into biophysics now, I think, which, thank heavens I'm not in that, because that that seems to be such a big field, such a big field. Yeah.
So do you still have notes or papers or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I don't have anything, I'm afraid. As I said, I fill lots of waste paper baskets. And I guess that access to those is now well and truly gone. There was no email in those days, so there's no trail to follow. The only things I've got from that era are, the copy of the Lesouche lectures, 1973. Not so long ago, as before Sam died, there was a book published called Stealing the Gold. Have you heard of that? Yes. That makes an interesting read as well. And I look at that and I think, wow, gosh, was he busy or what? Yeah.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Oh, no, pleasure. Yeah. Look.